number of presenters on today's session, but as part of this, since this is an ongoing series, I'd like to introduce Emmy Laiha from EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office to talk about the webinar series. So Emmy, I'm going to call up those early presentation materials to talk about the series and let you introduce the series to our audience.
Sure. Thank you, Jean. So you heard Jean mention the Federal Facilities Academy. So what that is exactly, it's a series of 11 webinars, one of which you're participating in today, and one in-person course. And this was originally developed to help EPA RPMs, project managers from other federal agencies, state government, tribal groups, basically anyone who works on federal facility cleanups under CERCLA, to help provide a better understanding of how we implement CERCLA at these sites. What are some of the challenges that we face regularly? It really is intended to supplement some of the other training that's provided. I did want to mention very quickly, there are the in-person trainings, which are available through trainex.org, and we do have those listed for this year. So if really quick, I'm going to read these off. Our next offering of that is going to be in Chicago, April 7th through 9th. And then we have another offering of that three-day course in Denver happening July 14th through 16th. So if you are participating in the Federal Facilities Academy and you're hoping to complete all the webinars and the in-person course to receive your certificate of completion, be sure to check out those in-person courses. The in-person courses are limited, though, in who can attend. You do need to be a federal or state representative or from a tribal group. Unfortunately, it's not open to groups like contractors. So that's one hesitation. But the webinars are open to the public. Any and all are more than welcome, even if you just know people who are interested in federal facility cleanups, to take those webinars. I think that covered everything, Jean, unless you can think of anything I missed.
Yes, I'm just going to remind everybody very quickly, as Emmy said, so this series is divided up into the online webinars and then the in-person classroom training. So remember, these online webinars are open to the public. They're taking place live, but you can also replay those recorded versions. For that in-person classroom opportunity, it's only going to be offered live, so you won't be able to replay that. So you either attend in person or you will miss out on that. We are offering individual certificates for each one of the webinars, and you can get one whether you attended each webinar live or you replayed some of them or replayed all of them. It doesn't matter, but you can get a webinar for each and every one of the individual webinars. You can get a certificate for that. And then, as Emmy noted, if you want to get the Academy certificate, which means you've participated in all of the webinars, either live or online, and attended an in-person classroom training, you'll then be able to get one of those certificates for the whole series. But you have to do that in-person training and be eligible to take that in-person training in order to get the Academy certificate. So if you have additional questions, you can reach out to Emmy and I on that one. I think with that, Emmy, why don't we go ahead and call up the presentation materials and get ready to transition over to our presentation content.
Okay. All right, it looks like the slides are up and we're ready to get started. I'll just quickly introduce myself. My name is Emmy Laiha and I work in the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office at EPA headquarters. And we are a relatively small office, but we have a lot on our plate, as do those who work on federal facility cleanups. And we'll have our contact information at the end of this webinar should you have any questions as we go over the materials. So let's go ahead and get started for today. We're looking at resolving issues before formal dispute, and we'll also talk about what happens once you get to that formal dispute level at your site, which does happen, and that's okay. And we'll talk more about that. But before we jump into the slide content, we'd like to get a better sense of who's joining us today. So we're going to do a group poll, and what we want to ask you all is, what type of conflict have you experienced at federal facilities? Perhaps I'm making a big assumption that you've experienced some sort of conflict. If you haven't, that'd be great to type in as well. But if you have had some kind of conflict during your efforts in federal facility cleanups, we'd love to hear about it. What was it? Was it resolved informally or formally? Did you were you able to resolve it at the site project team level, or did it get escalated? Just a few words on what your experience has been would be great.
And while we're waiting for some of those comments to come in, I'll remind everybody that you're going to see responses appear in the lower left corner of your screen. As you're reading some of the answers that your co-students have put in there, if you happen to have also had that same type of conflict experience, hover your cursor over an answer. You'll see a plus one appear on the right. You can click that plus one to sort of vote or agree with that response. So scan through, look for types of conflict that you've experienced, and we'll be able to very quickly get a sense of what the audience has gone through in terms of their own experience. And, I mean, I'm starting to see a lot more responses come in there, and we're starting to see which ones are the most common across our participants.
Wow, that's great to see so many people chiming in on this. It'll really help just give us a sense of perhaps why you joined this webinar today. Seeing a lot of agreement or yes votes for conflict over sampling requirements. Then agreement on ARARs, that is a big one as well. What else do we have coming in? State versus federal standards, okay. Conflict over taking a response action to address threats. All of these are getting multiple votes from our participants today. What else do we have coming in? Those are the top ones, but a lot of activity on this answer. So maybe it wasn't that big of an assumption to think we've had some conflict at our federal facility site. lead agency versus state agency. Requiring action that the federal government has no mechanism to implement. Okay. So there are a lot of problems to be solved here, right? And we're hoping that in today's webinar, we'll be able to give you some tools and techniques to help with these efforts, and then a better understanding of what happens when you get into that formal dispute process. Jean, was there anything I missed or other things we should highlight before we move on?
We had a few people write in that there were conflicts over regulatory definition regarding waste sites with their state agencies.
Ah, okay. Very, very big issues to tackle. So let's talk a little bit more about that and how we're going to cover it in this webinar. So we're going to talk a little bit about how you can best prepare for dispute. We'll talk about tools and techniques related to communication, how those can help with resolving disagreements because, as we can see, they're going to happen. And then once you're past that informal stage and get beyond informal dispute resolution, what actually happens in the formal dispute resolution process? So let's go ahead and jump into it. I'm on slide 4, our first introduction slide. And I think one of the most important things to remember is that disagreements are bound to arise. We have different agencies with different missions all coming together to clean up contaminated sites. And with the different missions, time frames, cleanup costs, all of these things are really going to feed into that potential for conflict. With this little graphic on the slide, I love it. Have you ever been at a meeting like this where two or three people are like in a heated conversation and the others are just like kind of step back watching it all go down? I personally have been in a few meetings like that, and so I just laugh when I see these penguins engaging in whatever is going on here. But anyways, it is really important to acknowledge that disagreements are going to happen, but have a plan to work through the issues. That way, you know how you're going to deal with them, and it's not reworking, making the wheel every single time. And informal dispute is an option that really allows project managers to attempt to resolve a disagreement without having to elevate it further. One thing you're going to hear me say quite a lot today is keep it at the lowest level possible, because it's probably going to be easier to have that conversation closest to the work. And once it starts getting elevated and more people start coming into the conversation, it does get a bit more challenging at times to work through those conflicts. All right, next slide. Continuing the introduction, if we can resolve our disagreements or disputes in a timely and collaborative manner, there's quite a few benefits, right? Maybe less work stoppages. That would be great. Faster cleanup time frames. I think everyone can be supportive of that. And just reduce delays in meeting milestones. Essentially, less time spent on resolving disagreement and hopefully pushing work forward. Those are just some of the pros of, okay, we're going to disagree, but if we can get this resolved sooner than later, then we could all benefit from that. Okay, on the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about the nature of conflict, which I've already alluded to. There's different reasons that conflict occurs. One big reason really is the differing missions of our agencies. You have each federal, state, or other agency that has maybe a very different outlook, a very different way that their missions are structured, and they're charged with coming together and doing cleanup together. So all of these things are going to be affected by cost, the agency mission scope, what are the resources that are available, and often there's competition for those resources, right? What's a reasonable timeline? Is, you know, 10 years, 100 years, 500 years? And finally, what cleanup goal should be used? So all of these things, how could we not have conflict when discussing cleanup at our sites, right? There's just so many different things to consider, which is why it's even more important to have a plan to get through those disagreements. So here on slide 7, when we're looking at the nature of conflict, I love the image on this page. So when it comes to data, we love data points. We love looking at all the information, right? But it's very interesting that different groups can look at the same set of data and see very different things. So with the image that's here on the screen, this is artwork by Octavio Ocampo. What do you see? When I first looked at it, I saw the face of an older man. But perhaps you see a man on a horse going through a cavern. So, again, we're looking at the same image, but how we perceive it can be different. So that's what makes it really challenging. You think, oh, we have science, we have data, this is exactly the right answer. But if you're taking different conclusions when analyzing that data, that can be very difficult to engage in conversation. It's like, how can you not see this is an older man in this image? What are you looking at? What are you doing? But it's just how it's perceived, and working through that, getting through that miscommunication is so important. And what fuels the fire, so to speak, is the terminology that we use. Clean, to me, might not be what clean means to my partner at another federal agency. Or controlled might have a different meaning as well. So all of these things, that varied use of terminology, really understanding what each other means to say and identifying what the general needs are of everyone at the table are so important to try and avoid that miscommunication. Okay, going on to slide 8, this is preparing for dispute. I'm going to hand it over to Mary Cook. Mary, do you want to introduce yourself and start the next section?
Great. Thanks, Emmy. Hi, my name is Mary Cook. I'm also with the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, and I've been with EPA for about 22 years doing mostly cleanup in federal facilities. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about preparing for dispute. So there are 174 federal facilities on the NPL, the National Priorities List, and EPA is responsible for overseeing their cleanup under CERCLA, Section 120. All but two of the NPL sites have a negotiated and finalized FFA, the Federal Facility Agreement. Get to know your FFA. It highlights not only dispute resolution, but access the roadmap for document review timelines, what is a primary versus a secondary document, and a plethora of other issues. Each federal facilities agreement describes the process for dispute resolution. Who can invoke a dispute? For example, the EPA, the other federal agencies, or even the state. A commitment that the parties will make to make an effort to informally resolve the dispute at the technical level, be it the remedial project manager or the level of the immediate supervisor. And you heard Emmy touch on this, you know, the lowest level of the chain possible to make these resolutions. And if a resolution cannot be achieved at the team level, the FFA describes the procedure to resolve a dispute. It provides a timeline, outlines who participates in the dispute resolution committee or the DRC. Different federal facility agreements may use different terms, but the levels for dispute resolution are similar. In this next slide, on slide 10, this is a snapshot of Section 12 of the Dispute Resolution section of Travis Air Force Base. This is in their Federal Facility Agreement on page 27. And I'd like to point out a section right sort of where my arrow is here. As mentioned, the FFAs describe the process for dispute resolution. This section primarily discusses the steps for formal dispute resolution, But does begin by encouraging informal resolution in this section 12.1. All parties to this agreement shall make reasonable efforts to informally resolve disputes at the remedial project manager or immediate supervisor level. It's right here. And as such, we will spend the majority of the time in this course discussing informal methods, and we're going to end briefly discussing formal disputes as well. So informal dispute. There we go. Okay. The informal dispute, this begins with discussion at the project team level. And it may include immediate supervisors, like I mentioned before, typically the first line supervisors, and potentially technical assistance folks, like a toxicologist or an ecological support member, depending on your organization structure. And it may include preliminary discussions with legal representatives. You may want to bring in some attorneys at this point just to clarify issues if need be. Discussion should continue as long as team members agree progress is being made, but should be elevated promptly when progress has stalled. Don't let the issue linger. Once it's clear you're at a stalemate, it's time to move on. And remember, asking for help or evaluating an issue, it's not a sign of failure. Sometimes resolution might require a fresh set of eyes or the assistance of someone who's not as connected to the site-specific issues that we're dealing with on the team level. They may be able to give you a little bit of insight that you're just too close to the subject matter to see. In formal dispute, the DRC serves as that first level of formal dispute resolution for which agreement has not been reached through informal dispute resolution. Following elevation to the DRC, the DRC is given a schedule in which to unanimously resolve the dispute and issue a written decision. And this committee is typically done at that Superfund division director level. If the decision is not unanimous, it's elevated to the senior executive committee, which is defined in your FFA. This includes the lead cleanup agency, state senior executives, and typically the RA level for EPA. This level of involvement would resolve in a work stoppage of the site, the issues in question, until such time as that dispute's resolved. If it's not resolved at the SEC level, this can be elevated to the EPA administrator. And why the EPA administrator? And a lot of other federal agencies are, you know, if you're on the line probably thinking, hold on, I thought we were the lead agency. Executive Order 12580, which delegates presidential authorities under CERCLA to the heads of the various executive branches, it does delegate certain circumstances, making the other federal agency the lead agency at the site. But EPA maintains authority over remedy selection based on CERCLA 120. And the delegation by the EPA administrator to an officer or employee of EPA or to the head of another federal agency, this cannot be transferred to another person. This basically means that final decision maker in a dispute, that final remedy selection, this will ultimately be made by the EPA administrator if it gets elevated to that level. So time for a little quick quiz, a little apply your understanding. There it goes. And thank you, Jean. You've already queued this up.
I know. So we'll just remind the audience that there's going to be a new box in the lower portion of their screen in the bottom left. And you'll be able to read through those responses and then click the boxes to the left for whatever you believe are the correct answers. So this is sort of a multiple answer question. You can click on multiple responses there. Mary, did you want to read off the question for our friends who might be just on the phone?
I will. Great. So which of these are an example of an informal dispute? And we have four choices. A difference of opinion when the parties are determining how to implement institutional controls to limit groundwater use until the aquifer is restored. B, resolving disagreement between the lead cleanup agency and EPA on determination of applicable and relevant and appropriate requirements or ARRs at the director's level. C, one party wants to use certain technology in a cleanup while the other parties want to use different technology. Or D, a disagreement between the parties over identifying a preferred alternative and a proposed plan. And we'll give you a couple seconds here to put in your answers. I see most folks are. And remember, this can be multiple choice.
All right, Mary. I say we open it up and let's see what the right answers would have been.
All right. Well, the right answers are answers A, C, and D. These are examples of project teams working together through the CERCLE process. B could be a formal dispute because we do mention here that it includes managers at the director's level. So that's actually going to elevate it a bit, and I see that most folks here are getting the idea. Almost anything can be kept at the informal level, but when we start moving it up that management chain, then we start getting more into the formal dispute world. So how does one prepare for dispute? Your dispute resolution team should be identified early in the process. In addition to your immediate project team, you heard me mention a little bit before, you might want to be including states who may be a signatory to the FFA. You also might want to be including tribes and other possible stakeholders. Many issues or informal disputes may be resolved among the team without proceeding to full-blown formal disputes. And like we mentioned a few slides ago, there may also be situations where it's really helpful to bring on technical experts or other subject matter experts into the conversation when there's disagreement. An attorney could clarify legal requirements. You know, a toxicologist would be able to help clear up toxicological or maybe risk assessment issues. You know, hydrogeologist if we're talking about groundwater. If there are differing opinions, bringing in a facilitator or maybe an immediate supervisor in at this point may also assist with understanding differences and consideration of different perspectives on the issue. Build relationships across your team. Meeting regularly and interacting with your team is important. Face-to-face conversations are infinitely more effective than calls or emails or texts. There's less of an opportunity for misunderstandings, and it can be difficult to understand tone in an email. I don't know how many times I know I've done it where I send an email thinking I am being really clear or maybe mildly sarcastic and trying to be funny, and it's just not taken that way. So putting things in writing, while you know it documents everything and you think it's great, sometimes context is lost and sometimes that tone is lost. So when at all possible, try to do something in person. During these interactions, each group should be encouraged to speak openly about the agency's desired outcomes and goals. Our agencies may all have the same, our general outcome is going to be protection of human health and the environment, and I think we all want to do the right thing. But we may have different missions and different ways of getting there. Again, we all want that similar outcome of protection and risk reduction. It's also important that each person be respected and be shown respect, and also show respect for others when we're having these interactions. Team members should feel comfortable expressing their opinions and participating in conversations. Emmy will be going into a little more detail about communication in the next section of slides. When we're meeting in person, develop a clear agenda with input from the various parties in advance so that each team member can be prepared and know that they are an active participant in the process. You want to make sure that everybody at the table or everybody on the call, if that's how you've chosen to have the meeting, is participating, fully participating in the meeting and fully participating in the decision-making process. It's also helpful to determine in advance who needs to be present at these meetings so that decisions can be made or whether or not elevation is the next step. Do we have the decision makers necessary? Are we, as a team, the decision makers necessary to make sure that we can move past these issues? And if that's not the case, do we have the right folks at the table to help us make these decisions and keep us from moving forward into a more formal dispute? Maintaining regular communication can be a great way to avoid or prepare for conflict. Maintaining communication and a cordial relationship outside of these meetings can help to reduce the likelihood of conflict. Ideally, every team member would feel comfortable picking up the phone and calling one another to ask a question or provide input. And additionally, being flexible can be very useful. There are multiple ways to achieve desired results, and thinking that there's only one acceptable answer to a problem can really cause tension. It's perfectly acceptable to be open-minded when having these discussions. Keep in mind that there's no single silver bullet remedy that can be fully protective of human health and the environment at your site. While your ideas may be perfectly acceptable, your teammates may also have some great suggestions. And who knows, maybe that best decision is a combination of two or three, piecemealing some of your ideas together, coming up with a better, more robust plan. Compromise and flexibility are really important when you're having these discussions as well. And like you heard me mention earlier, compromise doesn't mean it's not a loss. Compromise just means you're working together to come up with a better answer. It's not a we win versus, we lose. It's how do we do what's best for the site, do what's best for the public as we're cleaning up these sites. Teamwork works best when everyone acknowledges each other after something is said or an idea is thrown out to the group. Listen actively to the ideas and concerns of your team members. Encourage out-of-the-box ideas and offering solutions, alternative solutions to ideas that you may not think of or you may not think are the most suitable. Be open to those, but be open to discussion as to why they're viable. It can save the group from a lot of getting too wrapped up in an issue and not seeing outside the box, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. We come into some of these meetings as we prepped, thinking that we know what's going to be the right answer coming out of this. And like I talked about in a few of these slides, be open to these discussions and be open to being able to make like a hodgepodge of ideas, and you might find that that's actually the best idea. So, Emmy, I think I'm going to turn it back over to you with communication unless you have any questions here.
No, I think we can continue on. I'm going to just pause and see if we've had any questions come in. And just a reminder to everybody, you can type in your questions at any time on any of the content that we're going over, and we'll try and pause between each section to address questions as they come in.
Thanks, Emmy. We've had a handful of questions, but I think they're better saved later on.
Okay.
So let's carry on with the slides.
Okay, sounds good. So just getting to my slides here, one second. All right, so Mary shared a lot of information on some approaches that you can employ to make sure that you're getting your team together and have those open pathways for communication. So I want to talk a little bit more specifically about how to get that good communication going on your team. So first thing we want to talk about when it comes to communicating is listening. It's not just about saying what you have to say, but also listening to what's being said. So what I want to talk about is active listening. So it's very easy in these conversations that tend to cover perhaps topics you've talked about multiple times before with your counterparts regarding a particular site. I mean, our sites for federal facilities typically are large and complex with very long cleanup timeframes. So we can be engaging in conversations and meetings for years with maybe the same team members. Maybe there's a lot of staff turnover over the years, which makes sense when we're looking at decades to complete cleanup in some cases. So when you're listening to that familiar story, so to speak, at a meeting, it's very common to automatically start thinking, like, how am I going to rebuke or rebuttal what's being said right now in this meeting? And that is a prime example of what active listening is not. You don't want to try and assume what someone else is going to say or form your rebuttal that you're ready to deliver at that meeting. It really is just about clearing your mind enough that you can listen to what's being said. You have those verbal cues to let that person know, yes, I'm listening to you. So a nod doesn't necessarily mean I agree with what you're saying, and you can clarify that. You can just say, I'm hearing you out. I'm listening. Because how many times have you been at a meeting and you're talking and the person, you know, your counterparts or whatever, you see a shaking of the head like, nope. Like they're already not listening and disagreeing with what you're saying before it's even out of your mouth. So those verbal cues, again, not in agreement necessarily, although you may agree, you might be on the same page, but it really is just saying, I'm hearing you, and I'm going to listen to you before I start to try and just have an argument with you. And I know that can be hard to do sometimes, but it really is a good starting point when you're coming into a disagreement and that you're trying to resolve early and quickly. Remember that everyone should have the chance to be heard. You don't want to be cutting others off in a conversation because you know what they're going to say or you just assume that it's wrong. Let everyone say what they have to say. It feels good to be heard. And then from there, after not interrupting each other but allowing people around the table to say what they would like to say, then you can get into the next step. So after active listening, we get into repeating what you thought you heard. So I forget what the stats are. There's a lot of numbers thrown around, like you only retain 20% of what you hear, or honestly, I don't think those numbers are based on a ton of scientific studies, but it's fair to say that you don't remember 100% of what you hear. And when I say you, I mean we as humans cannot 100% recall things that we only hear. So it's really helpful to repeat what you heard another person say, at least what you think you thought you heard. So they provide their stance and you can be like, okay, so I think what I heard you say was X, Y, and Z or whatever it might be. So that really allows for mutual understanding. And if there is a misunderstanding, it creates an opportunity for discussion and clarification because that person can say, no, no, that's not what I meant. That X is not a priority for my agency. It's actually Y and Z that are really important. Oh, okay, I understand you better now. Again, not that you necessarily agree, but just clarifying you even understand where that other group is coming from or that other person is coming from can be so valuable. Very simple technique, but very, very commonly not seen at meetings. How many times have you been sitting at a meeting, it's like ping pong, you know, it's going back and forth, and in your mind you're like, wow, these people are talking right past each other. And honestly, they're not that far away from each other. But given the nature of the discussion, you would think there was a huge argument happening. So again, actively listening and repeating can be very easy techniques to employ that can help so much with the conversation because it really fosters that mutual understanding. And if you're still struggling, sometimes it helps to reduce the issue to writing. Each party can write up what their stance is or what their understanding of the problem is, and that can also help. So not only are you hearing it, but you can see it written out, and that might actually be the best way to clarify where the disagreements are. Okay, going to the next slide. Here we go. All right, so the next thing I want to talk about as far as communication is behavior, particularly at those tense meetings. So how many times have you been at a meeting and someone maybe has a bone to pick over an issue that happened a couple years ago, 5 years ago, 7 years ago, what have you, and the meeting is about this one topic, and lo and behold, you're talking about the same topic you comes up, rears its ugly head at every single meeting. You really, if you're participating in these meetings, hopefully if you're the one who's doing that, if you're able to acknowledge it and just really let go of those issues that have already been resolved, even if you were not entirely content with the resolution, leaving those in the past and really just focusing what's currently being disputed. Avoid that big laundry list of all the issues you ever had with the site and let's focus on the core issues at these meetings. There's always going to be more to handle, right? Well, how does that saying go about how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Not that I recommend eating elephants at all, but just as a saying, you have to take it piece by piece. So keep that in mind. Focus on what's important and the problems that have to be solved now and progress forward from there. You can highlight those that currently need to be addressed and maybe do a parking lot or some kind of binning of those other items to revisit at a later time. Etiquette when it comes to behavior. Again, be respectful of each other. I know sometimes that can be a little trying when you've been struggling with a conflict for an extended period of time. It might also help to try and take a look at the problem anew, like take that fresh look, really try and let go of other baggage and just focus, okay, going to put all that to the side. I'm going to try and look at this with new eyes. What does that get me? What different perspective does that offer me and my team in this conversation? So we have another apply your understanding. So we can go through this together. I think Jean will be pulling that up. So the question is, which of the following is not an example of practicing good communication across a site team? So it's a one choice answer. So a difference of opinion when the parties are determining how to implement institutional controls to limit groundwater use until the aquifer is restored. B, resolving disagreement between the lead cleanup agency and EPA on determination of ARARs. Actually, I think I'm reading the wrong, sorry, I think we might have, do we, Jean, are you seeing the same answers I'm seeing?
I am, and it may have been an error on my part. So, what we're going to do is make this really easy. So, I'm going to edit this. Bear with me, everybody. I know you were answering, but those don't line up with the ones on the slide. So, we're going to do something really quickly. And now we're going to make it easy. A, B, C, or D. A, B, C, and D are listed above. So you can just reference the slide above and then pick your answer.
Here we go. Yeah, so hopefully you can read that on your screen, okay? The question is the same. Which of these is not an example of good communication? Providing a written summary of my agency's understanding of an issue and our stance. B, asking clarifying questions once another team member has presented their thoughts on a topic. C, raising issues that are not relevant to the current situation. And D, disagreeing with someone from another group and explaining why I disagree. So looking at the answers as they're coming in, it looks like we were able to clearly identify which of these is not a good communication approach, and that is C. Raising issues that are not relevant to the current discussion. It's really helpful to try resist the urge to do that. Sometimes, though, you might bring up something that the group hadn't considered, and everyone can agree, oh, wow, that's actually really important and really relevant to what we're discussing. Let's talk about that, or let's capture that somehow. But sometimes the issues are out of left field, and you're like, oh, that's not what we're talking about right now. So just keep that in mind. As far as the other items, we had a couple of votes for D, disagreeing with someone from another group and explaining why I disagree. I actually think that's a good communication skill or technique to use, right? You're like, okay, these are the reasons why I don't agree with you. You can provide whatever facts or assumptions that support that statement, and maybe there's a mutual understanding that can be found through that conversation, because if we disagree, then there's likely conflict there. So let's look for, you know, how we can resolve that. So it's okay to disagree. We're not always going to be on the same page with our partner agencies, other regulatory agencies, cleanup agencies. There's going to be disagreements. But being able to articulate what they are and what the assumptions and facts are associated with that disagreement are going to be so helpful to being able to move the conversation forward. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments that came in on this, Jean or Mary, did you see anything?
No, I don't see anything else in the queue. And I just want to do a real quick time check. It's 1:43 p.m.
Okay, thank you. All right, so for now, let's go ahead and continue on, because we want to get to the formal dispute part of the webinar, which will be really exciting. But before that, I want to talk a little bit more about resolving disagreements. So what are some steps that you can employ if you're just, you have this troublesome situation going on with your site team? Say you're sitting in this right now. What can you do maybe that is different from what you've tried before? So in preparing for resolution, first and foremost, acknowledge that the disagreement exists. Sometimes we want to just assume it's part of normal conversation, like, well, I don't like that. Okay, well, whatever. Let's just get the schedule lined up and let's just move forward with these documents. So, okay, if there's an issue there, let's talk about it early, because if we can get through it early and hopefully more quickly than with kicking the can down the road, then that's going to be helpful for everyone. Also, once you acknowledge there's a disagreement, acknowledging what the potential impacts are from that disagreement. Does it affect cost? Does it affect schedules? Does it affect cleanup alternatives? Like, what is the scope of impact from having that disagreement? Sometimes you want to remember to look at the big picture. There are smaller details where there's more flexibility, where maybe it's easy to come to a compromise, and there's something where the impacts are very great, and it's not as flexible, and those things need to be worked out. And if you can agree to a cooperative process where instead of digging in and being stubborn, we're rather working together to find solutions, then that's going to help the process overall. And again, it comes down to communication. Can we speak with each other to put the pieces together so everyone can get what they need from the discussion? So once you've started to prepare for resolution, step two is to understand the situation. There's going to be varying points of view, right? We've hit that topic quite a number of times. And it's really helpful if each group can clarify their position so everybody understands where each group is coming from. Again, avoid assuming that there's a silver bullet or one single way to do it right, because usually there are multiple ways to get to that endpoint. So in this scenario, we're looking at three groups, and this is regarding remedy selection. This is entirely made up, so just to give us something a little more real to work with. So say group Alpha believes a groundwater plume should be remediated through pump and treat. Beta believes that the contaminated groundwater should be addressed through monitored natural attenuation, MNA. And Gamma believes that more data is needed. I'm actually a little curious how many people have actually been in a conversation like this. Maybe we could ask that question later. Anyway, this is the starting point, the starting stance of these three groups. So then we continue to understand the situation, right? You want to clarify the issue and dispute. What are those facts? What are those assumptions? Let's get them out on the table and talk about them. So in this scenario, you get a little more information. Alpha says, well, we think pump and treat is best because it's worked across the site in other areas with similar types of contamination. And Beta says, well, MNA seems more appropriate here because we have these relatively low concentrations of contaminants. Why is pump and treat needed here? And then Gamma is like, well, we just think we need more data. We can't really articulate why. Okay, not the best argument, but sometimes that happens in conversations. So in this case, maybe it makes sense to break into smaller groups. Maybe there's too many people in the room or too many people at the table. Would it make sense to break into a smaller group, maybe look at the people who actually have decision-making authority at that level and discuss it with less people in the room, or do more people with more technical expertise lend to the conversation, figure out what works best for your group, and then get together and discuss. So I don't have an answer of whether Alpha, Beta, or Gamma was right in that scenario. I'll let you pick who you think or what compromise they might have come to. Anyway, so in step three, reaching agreement, remember, it's okay to be creative. It's okay to try and negotiate because most things are negotiable. Can you find that win-win for the parties involved? Avoid getting so stuck in your viewpoint that you really fail to identify that there's other options that could be employed. Individually, I would say maybe it's good to get that reality check once in a while. You can talk about how you view the situation with people you trust and respect in your agency. It might be worthwhile to tell them, hey, this is my situation, this is what I think, what do you think? And they can say, oh yeah, I think you're right on. Or they could say, hey, have you thought about these other potential avenues to resolve your issue? It seems like, you know, we did this and it worked great. So getting that reality check can be really helpful. And again, go to people who are the experts. Is it technical experts, legal input, other type of scientific expertise that you can go after? Tap on those resources because they're going to be very useful as well. So as far as reaching agreement, one thing I want to highlight is if you all are just not doing well with communication, meetings are tense, you're not getting anywhere, consider if a facilitator would make sense for your group, a neutral facilitator to help overcome those communication issues because they can help with that and identify a path forward for the group with everyone's input. So that's always an option. And then when you do get to agreement and you get a win, like, celebrate that. We are so quick to focus on the negative, and we don't always take the time to celebrate our successes. Even if it's just moving something forward, that's a win for everybody, right? When we're not entrenched in those discussions or disputes or disagreements, we can try and move cleanup forward. So celebrate that. All right. We have one more activity for the group. I'll hand it over to Jean to get this set up.
Okay, so I'll just let everybody know that there's a brief video that we're going to be playing on the screen. The audio is going to play back on your computers. So for all of my speakers, please make sure your phone lines are muted right now. And for those of you who may have chosen to listen by phone, go ahead and turn the volume up. Even if the speaker's audio wasn't working online, you might be surprised to find that the video audio will work in Adobe. But if you do have problems with the Adobe audio, let me know in the Q&A window. I have another link I can send you so you can watch this video and follow along. While you're watching the video, look for examples of some of the do's and some of the don'ts, and you'll see some dialogue boxes below the video where you can start sharing your responses.
Okay, so this is the disputed poster. Now, one at a time, I want you to express your feelings using I emotion language and no judging or you statements.
I got this poster for Christmas, and I feel I want to see it every day. It makes me feel like the babies are the true artists, and God has a really cute sense of humor.
Come on, seriously, that? I don't like looking at it. It's creepy and in bad taste, and it's just offensive to me. It makes me think of the horrible, frigid stage mothers who forced the babies into it. It's kitsch. It's the opposite of art. It destroys art. It destroys souls. This is so much more offensive to me than hardcore porno.
Okay, okay. Stop. Let's see if we can't just brainstorm and find some creative alternatives that are win-win.
Win.
Yes, thank you, Pam. How about Angela makes the poster into a T-shirt which Oscar wears? That way he can never see it, and whenever she looks at Oscar, she can see it. Win, win, win.
No.
That's no.
Okay, well, brainstorm. Own the solution.
How about I leave it up?
How about she takes it down?
How about Angela can keep it up on Tuesdays and Thursdays?
Okay. That is called a compromise, and it is style 3, and it is not ideal. To sum up, win-win, make the poster in a T-shirt. Win-lose, take the poster down, compromise Tuesdays and Thursdays, and the answer is make the poster into a T-shirt. Win-win.
Win.
Fine.
But
it is done.
Okay, and so, Emmy, I'm seeing a lot of responses that were typed in below, beneath the video. So for those of you who were not able to view, a number of people have indicated some do's as well as some don'ts. And so some of the do's that I'm seeing is that they were looking for people to compromise, to brainstorm, to own the solution, told them not to involve emotions, acknowledged people when they brought suggestions to the table. And then there seemed to be a lot of answers on the don'ts, so aggressive language and tone, talking over one another, rolling their eyes, ignoring each other. Their body language was pretty offensive or aggressive. I mean, do you see anything else in there?
No, I think this was a great example. Like, if you were just looking for keywords, like brainstorming and own the solution, you're like, man, this group is on the right track. But when you see the skit, and it is meant to be humorous, right? It's from The Office. But I just was like, oh, my gosh, that's not how this works. That's not how any of this is supposed to work. But I found it helpful just to see it in that humorous context of, okay, There are do's and don'ts. There are communication techniques we can use. Yes, it's good to brainstorm. Yes, it's good to own the solution. Printing a T-shirt with the poster on it maybe was not the best win-win-win for everybody. But I'll pause for a second and just see if Mary had any other thoughts that we didn't touch on yet for the video clip.
No, I think between what folks captured in the boxes and what you've said, I think we've captured pretty much all of it.
All right. Good job, everybody. Thank you for participating in that. It's the first time we've tried that particular type of activity in a webinar. So thank you for typing in your answers. I found it useful, and I really enjoyed seeing what everybody was observing as far as body language, and maybe you can be more aware in meetings if you're rolling your eyes or being, you know, an aggressive stance or what have you, and maybe laugh a little bit remembering this video. All right, so we're going to go ahead and continue on, but I'm going to hand it over to Logan to introduce himself and then get into formal dispute.
Sure, thanks, Emmy. Hi, everyone. I'm Logan Senek. I'm an attorney in the EPA Federal Facilities Enforcement Office. Happy to be talking to you today. So I want to start this section by linking back to what Emmy said when we first started on the group poll, right? And I think this has been a theme throughout. Everyone has probably experienced conflict, probably at a federal facility if you've worked on one. And so I just want to start by saying that this is completely normal, right? Anytime you've got different people in different agencies with different priorities, different missions, different goals working on a project, it is not uncommon, and I would even say it's quite common or almost inevitable that some sort of disagreement or conflict will happen, and that is okay. So at a minimum, I mean, hopefully everyone is on the same goal of protectiveness of human health and the environment, cleaning up the site. Hopefully that's a common goal that's shared between all the parties. Moving on, we talked a little about informal disputes before. As Emmy said, you know, whenever possible, you want to resolve these disputes at the lowest level. They're the people closest to the situation. They'll have oftentimes the most intimate technical knowledge of the site. But as Mary said, you know, once there's no more progress, it's time to move on and move forward. So sometimes disputes can't be resolved informally, or they can't be resolved at the RPM level, and then it's time to elevate them so that they can be successfully resolved. So the standard timeline for an informal dispute in most FFAs is 30 days, but it can vary depending on the agreement itself, and you'll hear me say many times today, check your agreement, because that's the particular one that will govern. Sometimes they have minor differences, but generally it's 30 days. So both formal and informal disputes are anticipated parts of the process. That is why they are already in your FFAs. If you have an FFA that's been, you know, worked on since the 80s, it's been in there since the 80s probably. If you have one that you did last year or that's brand new, it's in there too. So really initiating a formal dispute is the appropriate action when there's no further progress that's being made. Moving on to the next slide. Before you elevate, though, consider a few questions. Is this really something that merits the involvement of upper management? Is it a technical issue that's best resolved, you know, as I mentioned before, by the people who are more closely involved with the site? Have you exhausted really all your options with being flexible and resolving it in another way? In short, really, you know, how would this dispute affect your remedy? Would it affect your protectiveness? And really make sure you get a sense of what that issue actually is before you elevate. If the decision is made to elevate the dispute, then first of all, most FFAs generally require this to be done in writing. So Emmy mentioned earlier, right, you can always put your thoughts in writing. You know, the in-person communication is so helpful to building relationships and checking for understanding and all of that. But there's also an opportunity in writing to kind of set out your view, let other people read it, digest it, understand it, take it back to their colleagues at work and figure out what you think or come to a better understanding of it. And so at whatever stage that happens, whether you put your ideas in writing earlier or you put it in writing when you raise the issue to a formal dispute, which is what's going to be required in your FFA, I would encourage you to think of this as an opportunity for progress. So this is a huge benefit. You get to put in writing what you think the problem is, right? So you can provide your rationale, you can focus the issue, you can help make sure all the other parties see the issue that you're laying out and kind of maybe eliminating some misunderstandings if they thought you had a different idea. So, briefly, I'm just going to talk about the steps that most FFAs lay out for dispute resolution. As always, of course, there could be one or two exceptions, but this is generally going to be the form they take. And I think, you know, you can refer to your FFA and see these in greater detail, so I won't belabor them too much. But basically, step one is going to be your DRC, your Dispute Resolution Committee. This is going to be your EPA Waste Management Division Director, maybe a federal facility manager, and an official from the state, if the state's a party to your FFA. Most DRC steps will give you 21 days to resolve the dispute unanimously and in writing, right? So now we're going to take this initial writing that one party says, here's my position, and eventually all the parties will come to an understanding that says, this is how we see the issue going forward. And if there's no resolution there, if you can't resolve it unanimously, it's supposed to be forwarded, this dispute, up to the Senior Executive Committee in a week. At that time, again, another opportunity for the parties to clarify their positions. They're going to submit a written statement of dispute up to the Senior Executive Committee. These are generally going to be pretty high-level executives, so EPA Regional Administrator level, some sort of equivalent level from the federal agency that's responsible for the facility. So you might be out of the facility at this point and into the broader organization that that's the owner of that facility, or that's the party to the FFA for that facility. And then usually something like the director of the state's environmental program. Again, short time frame, about 21 days to unanimously resolve the dispute and issue a written decision. I'm going to briefly cover steps 3 and 4. When a dispute is elevated from the Senior Executive Committee, it will go up to the Regional Administrator. The Administrator can issue, Regional Administrator can issue a written decision. If the other parties don't object within 14 days, that becomes the decision. If they do, then the Administrator, the EPA Administrator is the final arbiter of the dispute. So, in the history of all of our FFAs, though, it's my understanding that there have been less than a dozen disputes that have made it up to the administrator's level. So by far, most disputes are resolved at much lower levels, much earlier, after much less time, and they don't really need to go up to that level unless they're truly, truly intractable. Here's a quick summary slide that just shows the general timelines. It is, of course, not always possible to adhere to these timelines exactly. Sometimes there are troubles, as you'll see later. There can be difficulties with scheduling briefings with upper management, or maybe there's a time frame issue. But as always, you should make all possible efforts to avoid lengthy delays. A few examples where a formal dispute can occur. I think in addition to anything that we saw on the poll slide that Emmy and Mary had a little while ago that were all at the informal level, obviously if any of those disputes are not resolved at the informal level, they certainly could become formal disputes. But use of MCLs as cleanup levels, requests for extensions to deadlines, disagreements over ARRs, as we saw in the very first poll at the beginning, all things that can be a formal dispute if they're not resolved at a lower level. States can, of course, have a role in the dispute resolution process. So they, if they're a party, they can invoke formal dispute in the language under the FFA. Of course, check your FFA for details. Some FFAs have states that can collect stipulated penalties. States can make EPA aware of issues that may result in dispute resolution if they continue to persist. And so with that in mind, I want to turn things over now to Jean to introduce some of our state speakers, so Heather and Susan, and then I will say a few words about dispute resolution at the end.
All right, thank you very much. So I'm going to call up another presentation, and we're going to be joined by two speakers from the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. First, we'll have, we have Susan Fulmer on the line, who is a program manager of the Federal Remediation Section at the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control, where she works on management of staff overseeing the federal lead Superfund cleanups in South Carolina, serving as the state's federal facility agreement project manager for the Savannah River site. She's also a trustee Christy, representative for South Carolina DHEC on natural resource damage claims. Pardon me. She has over 17 years of state government experience and is a South Carolina registered professional geologist. We'll also be joined by Heather Cathcart, who's also joining us from South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. She is the Federal Remediation Coordinator for the Federal Remediation Section at the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. And her position there includes coordinating and overseeing all technical review activities associated with the implementation of the Federal Facility Agreement, or FFA. She has over 22 years of state government experience. So with that, we'll go ahead and turn it over to our speakers from South Carolina. And I believe, Heather, you are going to be joining us first.
Yes. Thank you, Jean. Good afternoon. I'm Heather Cathcart. Susan and I are going to spend a few minutes discussing how the state, EPA, and the Department of Energy have handled disputes on the Savannah River site high-level waste tanks. First, some background on the Savannah River site. The Savannah River site is located 20 miles south of Aiken, South Carolina, and occupies approximately 300 miles of land adjacent to the Savannah River and borders Georgia with Augusta, Georgia, located 25 miles to the northwest. The Savannah River site was constructed during the early 1950s to produce the basic materials used in the fabrication of nuclear weapons, primarily tritium and plutonium-239, in support of our nation's defense program and for research and medical programs. Five reactors and a number of support facilities were built to produce these materials. SRS was placed on the National Priorities List in 1989, and in 1993, DOE, EPA, and South Carolina DHEC entered into an interagency agreement, the Federal Facility Agreement for Savannah River Site, integrating the Circle of Response Action Process with the corrective measure provisions of RCRA. To date, 418 of the 515 waste units are complete or in a remediation phase. So the high-level waste, radioactive liquid waste, is generated by SRS as byproducts for the processing of nuclear material. The waste, totaling about 35 million gallons, is currently stored in 43 underground carbon steel waste tanks grouped into two tank farms, F and H area. 24 of these tanks are old style and do not have secondary containment. 8 of the old style tanks have identified leak sites, 6 are located in the water table, and 8 have been closed. South Carolina DHEC considers these tanks the greatest risk to the human health and environment in the state. The tanks are regulated under the South Carolina Pollution Control Act through a state industrial wastewater permit. However, milestones are set in the FFA for bulk waste removal and tank closure activities. The tanks operate through the wastewater permit, and closure is conducted under the wastewater closure plan. Once a tank is closed and exits the wastewater permit, the tanks are addressed by the FFA process for any needed soil and groundwater remediation. Now I will turn it over to Susan.
Thanks, Heather. So I'm going to walk you through the high-level waste disputes that have occurred at the Savannah River site, and we'll see how our handling of the disputes has evolved over the time. So in March of 2006, the Department of Energy requested an extension for the regulatory closure of two of the high-level waste tanks at the site. South Carolina did not agree to this request and issued a non-concurrence. Now, just as a reminder, DOE, EPA, and South Carolina are all equal partners in this federal facility agreement, so any one of the parties could invoke dispute. So we entered into an informal dispute in 2006, and then in October of 2007, the dispute was elevated to our Dispute Resolution Committee. Well, let me stop for a minute and point out that we spent a year and a half in informal dispute. As Logan and Emmy and Mary have pointed out throughout the webinar, informal dispute is a great way to make progress without the time constraints of formal dispute, but it's important to recognize when you're not making progress and it's time to elevate the dispute to the next level. So the dispute was elevated to the DRC, and 28 days later, which is the time frame that's specified in our FFA, the dispute was resolved. Okay, as part of this dispute resolution, bulk waste removal and operational closure dates for each of the remaining tanks were created, and they were documented in an appendix to our FFA. We set up an aggressive schedule, and that was created with the idea that a new treatment facility known as the Salt Waste Processing Facility would be in operation in 2011, and it would allow Savannah Riverside to close the tanks quickly. The agreement also detailed the requirement of an annual report on various tank closure activities, and the agreement memorialized a formal commitment from the Department of Energy to involve South Carolina and EPA throughout each stage of the tank closure process through frequent informal meetings or conference calls. So as a result, we began to hold quarterly conference calls where DOE would explain the treatment activities that they had undertaken each quarter. They would discuss with us the removal operations and the challenges that they've encountered throughout the quarter and the next steps that were planned to meet the objectives of closing those tanks out. We still have those meetings today, and they've been extremely valuable in developing a common understanding among the three parties. Now let's fast forward a few years. There's been some delay in startup of Salt Waste Processing Facility, and due to that and some other substantial technical and programmatic issues, Department of Energy requested an additional extension for bulk waste removal and tank closure milestones. First was in 2014 and the second in 2016. So as a result of those extension requests and denials by DHEC and EPA, we entered into two additional disputes. Okay, the 2014 extension request, we spent 3 months in an informal dispute, and we recognized that the issues couldn't be resolved at this informal level, so the state requested that the dispute be elevated to the Dispute Resolution Committee. The DRC was able to partially resolve the dispute within 28 days, and the remaining issue was elevated to the Senior Executive Committee. I want to pause again here and point out that again, you should work to resolve as many issues as possible at the lower level, and not everything needs to be elevated. You've heard that many times throughout this webinar today. But it's important to recognize that there are just some issues that only upper management can negotiate. And so when that's the case, and that was the case here, it was appropriate to elevate the dispute. For the remaining issue of dispute that was elevated to the SEC, the SEC was able to resolve it in 46 days. Now, this does exceed the 28-day time frame that's stated in our FFA, but this additional time was needed solely to find the time when the three parties were all available to meet. So remember, the SEC is the top management, and in this case, it was the site manager of the Department of Energy, the regional administrator for EPA, and the director of our environmental affairs in South Carolina. So when the Senior Executive Committee was able to sit down and get together, they met in person, and they were actually able to resolve the issue with just one meeting and in a few hours. Moving on to another dispute, in 2016, DOE requested another extension, this one to a bulk waste removal milestone, and again, it was not approved by the state or by EPA, so DOE invoked informal dispute. This dispute was resolved at the informal level, and it took about 6 months. The three parties held three in-person technical information exchange meetings during that time, and Department of Energy began providing a monthly tracking report to demonstrate their progress in meeting the milestone in question. So as part of the informal dispute resolution, both EPA and DHEC required that Department of Energy continue to submit that monthly tracking report, and we also asked them to commit to two additional meetings to discuss larger programmatic issues with us. Behind that commitment for those additional meetings was a common understanding between the three parties that Department of Energy had some substantial technical and programmatic issues that prevented them from achieving the milestones that were originally agreed to back in 2007. And, you know, we all knew that another milestone was coming up in 2017, and it was, again, going to be unlikely that the Department of Energy could meet it. So the three parties didn't really want to continue going into dispute, but South Carolina and EPA both wanted to hold the Department of Energy to their commitment. Okay, so we decided to look for a new approach to being able to resolve these issues. In September of 2017, once again, Department of Energy requested another extension, and these were for bulk waste removal efforts and operational closure of tanks. The three parties again agree that the aggressive tank closure schedule that was established back in that 2007 dispute resolution was not achievable and that the dates would need to be renegotiated. But at that time, there were issues that remained that prevented the three parties from being able to sit down together and to realistically reset the milestones to achievable dates. So while the state recognized that the extension would be needed, we did not believe simply extending the milestone would be adequate. The state wanted to see Department of Energy implement some other risk reduction at the site, even if that was within another area on site other than those at the tank farm. So rather than entering into dispute again, DOE, EPA, and the state agreed to suspend the 2017 and 2018 tank milestones while furthering our shared interest in continuing risk reduction at the site. So we looked for some common ground to be able to do this. So EPA and DHEC both requested that Department of Energy look at activities outside of the tank farms. DOE agreed to accelerate two soil and groundwater projects in D area, another area outside the tank farm. And they also agreed to maintain a good faith effort to advance the Savannah Riverside Liquid Waste Program by accelerating the closure of the F area tank farm. So these activities, the D area projects, and the acceleration of closure of the tank farm would further reduce site-wide risk. In exchange for this, the milestones were temporarily suspended rather than being extended. And pending startup of the salt waste processing facility that I mentioned earlier and some other programmatic issues being resolved, the parties would come back to the table and sit down and discuss the milestones and re-rack them to new, realistic, and achievable dates. Now, to show each agency's commitment behind this agreement, it was signed by the Dispute Resolution Committee, even though there was no formal dispute or even informal dispute on record at this point. The agreement was later extended in 2019 with an additional risk reduction commitment from Department of Energy. All right, so where are we today? Well, to date, the milestones for tank closure remain suspended while Savannah River Site continues to prepare for the salt waste processing facility startup. However, the acceleration of the 2D area cleanup projects is ongoing, and milestones for those accelerated projects have been placed in the federal facility agreement. Additionally, the regulators do remain in constant communication with the Department of Energy regarding the activities associated with the liquid waste program. All right, so I just want to wrap up with a few takeaway points from the various disputes that we've gone through at the Savannah River Site. And you've heard these throughout the webinar. First, it is extremely important that all of the parties make a good faith effort to try and resolve the dispute, and hopefully that can be done at the informal level. But, you know, if progress isn't being made, it is entirely appropriate to elevate the dispute to whatever level is needed to reach an agreement. It's important to know your FFA's dispute resolution timeframes and stick to them. You know, sometimes a deadline is the only motivation that you might need to get the job done, and I think that that served us well when we did choose to elevate the time frame, elevate the disputes to the DRC and SEC. We did strive to stick to those timeframes as best as possible. It's important to remember to look for common ground and to use that as a starting point for and a framework for establishing resolution, and to be creative and looking for options that satisfy everyone. A great example, I think, was our suspension agreement that we came up with, and we looked for activities that accelerated risk reduction at the site, and that was a win-win for all three parties. Finally, remember that once you've reached agreement, don't make assumptions that everyone knows and will remember what was agreed to, so be very clear about the specifics in your resolution, so that there aren't any questions or objections later on down the line. Remember, you know, personnel can and will change over time, so having this detail in your agreement is extremely important to ensure that that common understanding is transferred down to new staff as personnel change over time. Okay, well, we'll pause here and check in and see if there are any questions for us.
Yeah, we did have a couple of questions that came in, and I'll just remind the audience, you can send in your questions using that Q&A window in the lower right corner at any time. So one of the first questions we received, the audience wanted to know who elevated the dispute. Was it the state or a different agency?
Okay, so in our 2014 dispute, the state elevated it. We felt like at that point that we were not making much progress in the informal stage, and we needed to get it moved on up and have the benefit of the time frame that's specified in the FFA to help us resolve it. I believe
okay.
We also, I think I'll say the same for the 2006 dispute. I believe the state was responsible for elevating it and then, again, getting resolution in that 2007 agreement.
Okay, and I think this is implied throughout the entire dialogue, but somebody wanted to know, would you say that the time which was required for this informal dispute was worth it to get that overall project's progress moving forward?
So I'm not sure which dispute maybe they have in question. If it was the 2006-2007 where we had the year and a half timeline, I think that probably initially some of that time was needed to get familiar with the issues, because we're talking about high-level radioactive waste. So those are some really difficult issues to talk about and get your mind wrapped around. But as time progressed, I think that the state would say that we felt like things just were not progressing and we really needed to elevate it because it was just hitting a stalemate.
Okay.
And so we took that lesson to our 2014 dispute, and we didn't spend more than 3 months in informal dispute, and we knew that we weren't going to linger there for too long. We wanted to get it resolved.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't see any other questions right now in the queue, but if you're in the midst of typing a rather long one, you can continue to work on submitting that. We will have additional time in the presentation later on for Q&A. So I think what we'll do is we'll go ahead and transition back to our other presentation content so that we can carry on with the other slides, and then again, we'll pause again for Q&A. So let me call up those slides here, and if I'm not mistaken, Logan, I believe you are back on the line to carry on with the slides.
Yes. All right, yeah. So, as you just heard, federal facility agreements provide guidelines for how to resolve disputes, and many, many thanks to Heather and Susan for sharing their multiple success stories with us. With regards to that, the deadline suspension, I wanted to add, too, that parties can do a lot by mutual agreement. So you can even modify your FFA if all the parties are on board. And so there are ways to, you know, if you feel that the agreement is actually the sticking point, to adjust that to work for the site, to work for your group, to work for the cleanup. So, you know, you can take a look at those clauses in your FFAs and see how those work, too. So moving on to the next set of slides, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Superfund Task Force and the principles memorandum that came out of it, because I think many of you may find this helpful. These are things that will hopefully back up everything we've just said here today and provide some reference materials. They are going to be available on the website that provides the materials for this webinar, so you'll be able to easily access them later. So the Superfund Task Force was convened by former Administrator Pruitt in 2017 to address the slow progress of cleanups at Superfund sites. So several recommendations came out of the task force. In particular, one, recommendation 18, called for the reinforcement of the FFA informal and formal dispute timelines and for better tracking of those timelines and the disputes that were under dispute. So in response to that recommendation, EPA's assistant administrators for OECA and OLM issued a principles memorandum in September 2018. So this document is very short. You can read this. It's only, I think it's 4 pages. So this is not a heavy read, and you can see it on the webinar links. Basically, it describes a few principles that parties should think about when they are working on resolving these disputes. Among those generally stated are disputes are a natural part of the process. All parties should have a common understanding of dispute resolution procedures and should resolve them informally when possible. And informal disputes should be elevated when progress has stalled. So really, not too much outside of what you've heard today. So dispute resolution timelines, as always, should be followed to the greatest extent practicable, and each party to the FFA has a role in this. As you heard from the state, there are circumstances where you just can't get that meeting planned or the official involved is otherwise engaged. That happens. That's understandable, but obviously if no progress is being made at one level, it's time to elevate it to the next. So check out those documents on the links and on the site so that you can refer to them. And we will wrap up this section on disputes. So in conclusion, as I've said many times, read your FFA. It will provide you both direction for resolving your issue and the particulars of your FFA will govern for your site. Resolve issues at the project level when possible. As Heather and Susan mentioned, if you have multiple issues at a site and you can resolve some of them at a lower level, do that. Resolve those first. If you have 10 and only 8, eight can be wrapped up immediately, leaving only 2 to pass up to the next level, that's great. Resolve those 8, pass the 2 up to the next level, and move on. As always, promote teamwork. Prepare to handle disagreement. It is normal. Move on to formal dispute if substantive process is not being made in informal dispute as appropriate. And lastly, celebrate agreement. I think it is important to remind everyone that we're all in this, on the same plan of protectiveness and both to human health and the environment, and we're all working towards that same goal. So with that, anybody have any questions?
Okay, so I'm going to remind the audience that they can continue to send in their questions and comments using that Q&A window in the lower right corner of their screen. We did have a few questions that came in earlier, and so I'm going to go ahead and turn back to these questions, if you all don't mind. So this first question is asking if you or anybody who helped present today had thoughts or advice when the regulators dispute each other instead of the RP or responsible party. They are wondering if there are different procedures or things to consider, if you have any advice when they're in that situation again, when it's the regulators disputing each other instead of a responsible party.
Sure, this is Emmy. I can start the response, and then, of course, if any of the other presenters want to chime in, that would be great. So I've been in the room when the regulators, be it, for example, EPA and maybe a state agency, are perhaps not on the same page, like in your question here, that they're arguing with each other and the responsible party is really not part of that argument. So I think there's a few questions to ask in that case. Is there a lead regulatory agency? Should they be working better with that support agency? And it could be either or, depending on how your FFA is written between, be it a federal agency or the state agency. Like understanding those roles and when it's appropriate to defer, I have found in those types of arguments, sometimes it's helpful for the regulators to have a conversation, perhaps just between themselves, or they really go over what are the authorities present in the cleanup and how far do those authorities go. It's been my experience that one group might want a more conservative cleanup, but perhaps regulatorily there's only so far that cleanup can be pushed. And really understanding where the limits are, looking to see if there's any flexibilities, encouraging your regulators to have that conversation, and perhaps that responsible party doesn't need to be in the room to allow the regulators to delve through everything a little more comfortably might make sense. If those questions haven't been asked or they haven't had that discussion, that's definitely something to put on the table. And if it just is still really difficult for those regulatory agencies to have a conversation, maybe they need a third-party neutral person to come in and help them in that conversation. It might be that their overall goals are very similar. They're just having trouble identifying how to go about getting there. Mary or Heather, Susan, do you all have other thoughts?
No, I mean, this is Mary, guys. I think this is a great question, and one of the issues, I think, and I agree very much with what Emmy was saying, sometimes, you know, as transparent as you want to be with the entire team, sometimes there may need to be a discussion offline between, let's say it is the regulators, the state and EPA. Maybe there needs to be that conversation offline. One of the issues that we see fairly often is the question of AORs. And while AORs, they're pretty well defined as to what is considered to be an AOR. Sometimes there's not necessarily an agreement on whether something truly is. So that's a good time to take it out of that meeting, set up a separate call, maybe with if not a facilitator, maybe with first line management, and work through some of those issues without bogging down the meeting itself.
I have found when you have too many cooks in the kitchen, so to speak, and maybe different individuals are voicing their concerns, sometimes that gets confusing and it's difficult for the group to move forward. I think it's good for everyone to be heard, but ultimately you need a decision maker from each agency who's willing to say this is what we need to move forward, because you're not going to be able to please every single person at the table 100%. That's where the compromise comes in, and finding how you can negotiate to get to a situation where people mostly get what they need, but nobody really gets everything that they want.
And this is Logan. Great point. I think I would just add to that that, you know, if the regulated party is feeling that they're hearing one thing from a state and another from EPA, or if they feel that the parties, the regulating entities, aren't in agreement themselves, I think it's totally appropriate for that regulated party to say so, either through the disputes process or through another means, just to say, hey, you know, I don't think we're all on the same page here. And whether that happens through the FFA process or separately, I do think that makes sense.
Okay, we had another question that came in, and this participant wanted to know what you consider to be the best way to initiate an informal dispute. They were looking for some pointers. They had never done one before. They think that they might need one in their situation, and they didn't know who they should call or what they should do to get the ball rolling.
So I could understand that confusion. Like, when are you engaging in informal dispute? Because in your regular project team meetings, you might be talking through things where there are some disagreements or varying viewpoints, and you're determining how to move forward. So at that point, as long as you're making steady progress, you're not exactly in informal dispute. To me, that's your regular site work, and you're just moving through tasks and issues as they arise. However, when you feel like you're starting to get stuck in the conversation, or after that one meeting you're revisiting that issue multiple times, then you might be in that space of informal dispute. So I know we use the terms like invoking informal dispute. Sometimes there's not an official paper trail associated with that. Be sure to look in your federal facility agreement. Logan, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to write something up, although some regions do choose to send a formal letter saying, we are invoking informal dispute on the following topic. This is our stance. These are our concerns. We would like to get this resolved by X date. Like, that can be really helpful just as far as clarity goes, but not every region does that. So I would check with perhaps other your counterparts in the site or the region that you're working in to see what's typical, because it might be that you're proceeding with your regular meetings working through the issue. I think what you really want to ask yourself is, if you're stalled and you're not making progress, at what point do you need to make that informal dispute formal? Mary or Logan, other thoughts?
Yeah, I was actually just, I went back to Mary's slides because the Travis Air Force Base slide has some language. And what it says in there, it says, all parties to this agreement shall make reasonable efforts to informally resolve disputes at the remedial project manager or immediate supervisor level. And so, I mean, it really doesn't always provide specific clear advice, although there is another section after that that says, you know, how you raise a formal dispute. I think you may want to check your FFA because it may have something to do with the receipt of draft documents and things like that, but I would go with what Emmy said overall, this idea that, you know, the second in a meeting someone says, I disagree, that doesn't necessarily mean you're in a dispute, right? People have different opinions, and if your RPMs are talking and they're just disagreeing and coming to some answer later, I don't think that necessarily rises to the, you know, level of an informal dispute. But it is a little bit of a fuzzy line compared to formal disputes where you have, you know, a statement in writing that really sets the stage up.
Okay. I had another question that came in, and this one is an individual whose management is actually attempting or in the line of thought that they should pursue a formal dispute, but this individual would rather try an informal approach first, and they're looking for suggestions on how to convince their management that they should try the informal before barreling forward with a formal dispute process.
Well, I mean, so since we're on that slide, thank you for turning to that slide. As I'm skimming it again right now, I see 12.3 at the bottom says, during this informal dispute resolution process, the parties shall meet as many times as are necessary to discuss and attempt resolution of the dispute. So there kind of is this room for people to talk things out. And then I think you would have to kind of balance that and the whole reasonable efforts language against, you know, the other ideas of if no progress is being made, it's time to move on.
Yeah,
Emmy or Mary, do you have additions?
Yeah, I would jump in on that as well. I had mentioned that you, with these types of issues, the closer you are to the work, meaning the lower level you are in that management chain, I think the better decision that will be made for the cleanup. The higher you go up the chain, the more people who have to come to the table, the more people who have to get briefed up on the issues and the site challenges, who maybe don't have a lot of time to fully understand the complexities of your site, you're essentially handing over that issue to them to resolve. And there's times when that's appropriate, but if it is a technical issue that needs to be resolved, do you really want that getting out of your hands, so to speak? It might be that the resolution that gets decided on is something that your manager might not be happy with. Maybe, you know, unforeseen turn of events leave you with a decision that you kind of get stuck with. So that's one argument I make for keeping it as close to the site work as possible, is that you want to make sure the decision is best for what's at the site and is decided by the people closest to the work.
Right. This is Mary. I agree with what Emmy said. If you're having, if your management's coming in and especially, I guess without being asked, stepping in here, maybe that's a question internally for you, EPA, or whoever's management stepping in, and that's a side conversation internally, saying, hey, you know, can you just let us know what's going on, that you feel that we shouldn't be following the proper procedures as outlined in the FFA, because it sounds like it's, you know, being, there may be something that they are not making you aware of that is going on nationally, in which case that's you need to know that for the work being done at your site and for the decisions being made there. So maybe there is a reason that they've chosen to do that, but it would be very helpful if they let you know. And if it's just because they want to be involved, maybe it's time to remind them that, you know, nicely, of course, hey, by the way, we have this process as outlined in our FFA that we really would like to try and do this at our level and make the site-specific decisions as best we can. You know, this doesn't rise to your involvement as management yet.
All right. We have another question. Earlier in the presentation, there was a reference to bringing in a third party to help with conversations if they got difficult. Someone wanted to know if EPA offers mediation or facilitation services to help with these types of difficult conversations.
So EPA does have its Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, that's CPRC. You can Google that, EPA CPRC, and it should pop up. where we offer facilitation and mediation services. I believe this service would have to be requested through an EPA person. However, there are trainings that are put on by this group that might be helpful if you're a non-EPA person who wants to get better at resolving conflict for your site. So that the trainings are also available on that website. I know the Alternative Dispute Resolution Process, or ADR, is something that's being looked at more closely for implementation at federal facility sites where groups might be struggling with resolving their disagreements. So that's another option to look at. But I believe it would have to be your EPA person reaching out to get those services provided to the site.
Okay. I do see another question in here, and this one is just in terms of, like, documentation. So it's a longer question, but I think a number of people have indicated that sometimes it's about missing information that's leading to some of the disputes, and they're just having difficulty getting their hands on documents that they would think would be out there, publicly available, like cooperative agreements or DSMOAs. And so they were just looking for input. If there are documents that they can't get their hands on, where should they go? Where should they turn? Is there a standard set of resources that should be available at sites? Because I think it's just misinformation that's causing the dispute in this question.
Okay. So usually for sites, there's an administrative record, and the lead cleanup agency is responsible for maintaining that record. However, for something like the DSMOA, which is a Department of Defense State Memorandum of Agreement, that's an agreement between DOD and the state, and I am not sure if those typically get put into an administrative record file. My guess is that they may not, and so if you're looking for files like that, I would recommend reaching out to the DOD component that you're working with. If for some reason, you know, files do get lost, especially older files before we had extensive electronic filing systems. I believe there's a website that the Corps runs as a community portal that maintains a lot of that information. I think it's a DSMOA community portal, and that might be a good source to reach out to if you just look up their website. I believe they may have that on record, or at least could help you find it if it's specific to a DSMOA and a resulting cooperative agreement. At least I would start there. Unfortunately, EPA wouldn't necessarily have those files to offer.
That's a good point, Emmy. I think I remember doing some research a couple years ago, and I was able to find a good number of site-specific, and most of the states, most of the site-specifics through DSMOA, through the Corps. Now, is that still available? If that's still up to date, I'm not positive, but I do know that information can be out there.
Okay, so it looks like I think we may have actually gotten through all of the electronic questions that have come in. I know that there are one or two individuals who are just on the telephone lines, and they've emailed me to let me know that. So I just wanted to see very quickly if anybody who's on the phones, if you are on the phone only and you'd like to ask a question out loud, you can hit #6 on your phone to unmute and ask your question out loud. Okay. All right. I don't see any other questions in here in the queue, Emmy, although I will say that there were a number of people that were interested in the in-person training that you had referenced earlier in today's session. So I wasn't sure if you wanted to just revisit that, if we had some people who joined us late, just to remind people about the in-person delivery.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to share that again. Again, that's on trainex.org. When you go to that main page, you should see a list of events. If you look under Federal Facility RPM Training, you'll see that the next offerings of this are, again, in Chicago, April 7th through 9th, and then in Denver, July 14th through 16th. Keep in mind, if for whatever reason you're not able to travel to this training in fiscal year 20, we anticipate having a few more offerings in the next fiscal year, 21. So as long as there's a demand for this training, we'll try to keep working with our Circle Education Center to ensure that these are offered a couple of times a year.
Okay. And so, Emmy, I've got the last slide up on the screen. Any final reminders that you'd like to share with the audience before we close things out today?
Sure. Just wanted to let you know that this is our contact information. If you have any additional questions or want to reach out to FIFRO or FEO, please feel free to contact any of us, Mary. Again, I'm Emmy or Logan. We'd be happy to answer your questions. I did see one more question come in just before we wrap up today about, is the RPM training in Norfolk, Virginia in April the in-person training too? So as far as I'm aware, we don't have a Norfolk, Virginia federal facility RPM training scheduled. I don't know if that is for another specific topic, but I'll check the schedule just really quickly if people will give me 1 second to see what this is referring to. April, let's see. Yeah, no, I'm not sure what training it is. I don't think it's this specific federal facility RPM training, though, simply because I don't see that on the website. I do help to deliver those trainings as well. So as far as I know, there haven't been any plans for that. But should that change or be updated, we would definitely put that on trainix.org.
All right. Well, Emmy, thank you so very much. We did have a comment just that it could actually be training from someone else, so they'll go back and double-check their records. And as you noted, your contact information is up on the screen, so people can certainly reach out to you by email if they have additional questions about that in-person delivery. Okay. So with that, I'm going to come back on the line here and walk through just a few final reminders before we close out today's live broadcast. So the first thing I want to do is I wanted to thank all of our presenters, as those from EPA as well as those who joined us from South Carolina, who took time out of their schedules to share their expertise. And I also wanted to thank the over 135 individuals who joined us from around the U.S. for today's live delivery. If you liked today's webinar, you'd like to continue on with the seminar, I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network. You'll find us at cluein.org. You'll also be able to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month and helps highlight new documents, websites, and online training related to hazardous waste site cleanup. So again, I encourage you to visit us at Cluein and sign up for Tech Direct. Copies of the presentation material have already been posted on the seminar resources or links page. You'll find that on the middle right in the webinar environment under related URLs. Simply click on the seminar resources link and press the browse to button to open it. You'll also find those links. I just pasted them right into the Q&A window. You'll also find contact information for our presenters and organizers there. And I will ask each of you to fill out a brief online feedback form. We do get a lot of requests for certificates, and while we do not offer PDHs or CEUs, you can get a certificate which at least documents the title, the date, the length of the training that you participated if you submit a feedback form. So I encourage you to follow the link to the online feedback form, complete that feedback, making sure your email address is entered correctly, and that you check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you attended the entire session or replayed the entire recorded version. As soon as you submit that feedback form on in, you should immediately have access to a seminar certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. Sometimes they get lost in spam or junk folders, so that should display on the screen immediately upon submitting. You might want to save it right from that screen rather than waiting for the email copy. But if you don't find it, you can certainly reach out to me at ballant.jean@epa.gov, and I'll be more than happy to work to get you a certificate. If you happen to join together as a group, if you could please do me a small favor and share the link to the feedback form with anyone who joined you in the room. Each person in the room can fill out the feedback form to get their own certificate, even if they didn't register individually. So as long as you get the link and you share feedback, you can get your own certificate, again, even if you joined under somebody else's registration. And please know that we do value your input. I read each and every one of those responses, and we count on your input to help us to continue to deliver free online training like this. Today's session was recorded just like the others in the series, so in approximately 1 week you'll get an automatic email from me with instructions on how you can access this session, and I encourage you to share it with others if you think it will be a valuable use of their time. For those of you looking to complete the entire series, if you've sort of joined us midway through, the others are currently available on Cluein. You can go there, look at our archived webinars, and you'll also find a link to the other ones that are archived in the links under related URLs. So with that, I'll go ahead and thank everybody one last time, and we'll formally conclude today's live broadcast.